Today's episode of The Thriller Zone is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the brilliant new techno thriller 4 Minutes by the number one internationally best-selling author duo, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. 4 Minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple. And on today's show, we have a very special guest. This is a first-time author. And when you pick up this book, which I'm sure you will, you're not going to believe it. You'll swear that Ted Flanagan, his book, Every Hidden Thing, you'll swear that he's been writing his whole life. It's a knockout book. And I'm very excited to talk to Ted about it. So why don't you and I get in the Thriller Zone?
David, how are you?
I'm so good, Ted. How are you, sir?
Every day is a holiday. Every day is a holiday.
Why do I not believe that?
Well, Groundhog's Day is celebrated in many cultures, right?
I am so excited to talk to you. I'm not exactly sure why. I think because I've been so engrossed in your book. So thank you for joining the Thriller Zone.
Oh, listen, man, it's all my pleasure. I love the show. Like I can't believe I'm actually going to be on. I'm pretty pumped, man.
Well, we're going to be talking about Every Hidden Thing here, as I do every time. I tease everybody that we're going to be talking about this, and we're going to get to it. I have plenty to say. But first, I want to get to know you, Ted, because, you know, it all starts with you. If I know a little bit about you and your background and kind of what makes you tick and what you're made of, it helps me understand better the creative spirit behind you. And do I need to do that? Maybe some other podcasts don't, but I do. I like to know who I'm talking to. I really like to get inside your head because you can learn so much, and especially this kind of a story where you represent a world I have zero knowledge about. So I'm fascinated. So if I start asking you some of the same questions that you're like, oh, geez, I've heard these so many times, please bear with me.
Of course. Of course. No worries. It's a weird. So EMS is a strange sort of unexplored profession. So I definitely understand, so unfamiliarity. That's probably a good thing. You haven't been in the back of a lot of ambulances. So that's a good thing.
Do you know what? I have never been in an ambulance.
Knock on wood for that, man.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen my mother carried into one. I've seen my siblings. But I've lived a charmed, healthy life. And I, this is a funny side note. Not 7 minutes ago, I had some blood work done. They come to your house and they do it. I'm getting some kind of testing done. It's just kind of looking under the hood.
Right.
She starts opening these boxes. There's two, then there's four, then there's seven tubes. Okay, well, I'm a wuss. I see a needle and I just,
Oh, yeah.
So daddy's arm, got a little workout this morning and it wasn't lifting dumbbells.
Yeah, seven tubes. My goodness. Well, listen, if you feel faint, let me know. We can pause. I'm good with blood as long as it's not mine.
Yeah, well,
I'm missing my own blood. That's the only thing I can handle. Blood, just not my own.
Yeah, and on top of it, I had to fast, so this is my first cup of coffee of the day, and I'm so fucking happy right now.
Is there anything better than that first meal after you're done with a fast for some medical tests? There's nothing better.
I haven't had the meal yet. I'm going to get that as soon as we finish the show. but this right here, yeah. All right, so Ted, folks, you joining us and you are not familiar with Ted Flanagan, you will be by the end of the show. He's a paramedic. He's a former newspaper reporter. He served as a recon Marine, a 2nd Recon Battalion, which is another whole world. His writing has appeared in Shotgun Honey, Mystery Tribune, Cognoscenti, and his novel, Every Hidden Thing, which we're going to talk about, is published by Crooked Lane Books, which I have recently learned more about. They're kind of a small boutique publisher, but really kind of on the climb, right?
Yeah, I think they describe themselves as sort of a boutique. They focus a lot on crime and mystery and some cozy stuff. I've been aware of them for a while. And then there's my editor in the book is a guy named Ben Leroy, who founded Tyrus and Bleak House, some crime imprints back in the 90s and early 2000s. And he was a guy who I had actually been an admirer of his because so many books he edited were coincidentally favorite books of mine, Jonathan Keller's Vice and Sea, and Matt Hefty's A Hard Heavy Thing. And so when Ben went to Crooked Lane, you know, my agent immediately submitted the book to him because I just, he's a great guy. He's a great editor. I couldn't have been any luckier to publish with Crooked Lane and with Ben particularly. And also Sarah Henry, who works with Ben pretty closely as well. It's a small, but with a lot of horsepower behind that imprint.
I get that. I'm kind of a fan and a fanatic of a couple things. I'm a fanatic for book covers. You give me a good looking book cover and I'm all in. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because I'm a closet artist. And isn't it funny, Ted, you can spot a shitty book cover. Like when you see a homemade book cover, you can see it from a mile away and you're like, eh, isn't that funny?
Well, you know what, you can always tell, and no offense to everybody, we're all trying to do our very best, but you know, I used to do some ghostwriting for a company where you would show up and pay them a lot of money and they would, you know, they'd hook you up with me and I'd write your book for you. Then they'd hook you up with a marketing department and a cover designers. And the cover designers at this company had all worked for big five publishing houses, well, now big four. And so I learned a lot about cover design. And after talking to them, I can never unsee a bad cover anymore. So it's exactly like you say, the, you know, using stock photos, stock imagery. And it's, you know, if you see the same, you know, piece of a cover in eight different covers, I think I'm supposed to say the writing is all that matters. But if I'm in a bookstore and I'm browsing 100 books, covers matter to me. Be that as it may, you know, whether that's a sign of inadequacy in me or just a natural human reaction, a good cover is super important, I think.
I think it's a natural human reaction. And the form, you know, the old saying, don't judge a book by its cover. I disagree. You do have to judge a book by its. Yeah. And I think about, I have sitting in front of me, I won't spin the camera around. I have about 45, 50, maybe 60 books stacked on the floor. The reason I'm not going to show you is because it's a mess, but 40% of 40 of those 50, the covers are so tight, so dead on that you're like, yeah, I'll read that book probably because of the cover. Anyway, don't want to belabor that point. Just wanted to say that this Every Hidden Thing is a fantastic cover. And anything that makes you go, oh, that's an... And, oh, and then there's... And then you discover a little more things going on there.
Yeah, I like it. Did an amazing job. I couldn't have been... I mean, they didn't have to give me any input into the cover. And I was fortunate enough that they said they sent me different versions of it. And that cover just really... I felt like they really captured, if you can, in a cover, sort of the spirit of the book. They really nailed it, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about paramedic because your job, your current full-time job, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Yep. Your full-time job feeds one of the main characters in this book. And God, I got a profound respect for what you do. I respected what you did before. I'm like, man, yeah, that's important. But when you read what you guys go through on any given day, I'm like, wow, you really get to see what's scraped off the bottom of the shoe of society sometimes, don't you?
You know, I've tried to leave EMS, and I don't think that's anybody who's done the job for a long time is always trying to do something else because it wear on you. But I keep coming back to it because I genuinely still love treating sick patients. I still love almost all the job. You know, it's tiring. The pay is okay, but you got to work 70, 80 hours a week to make decent pay. But I was talking to my friend, John Vercher, a novelist. He wrote this amazing book, Three Fifths. He's got a great book coming out in the summer. I love the guy. One of my best friends in the world. And, you know, I sort of recently kind of stopped trying to leave EMS because I realized at a certain point, it's kind of my muse in the sense that I meet people. And the more I try to get into teaching and away from doing the work on an ambulance where I wasn't working maybe 70 hours anymore than the ambulance, my writing suffered because these people I may not write about EMS calls. I try very hard not to become like the paramedic writer. But I meet people I would never meet in a million years. You know, I've met the poorest of the poor, and I've met, you know, the CEOs of Fortune 100 companies and everything in between, and people from all religions and walks of life. And I always tell, when I have paramedic students, I tell them, like, the awesome thing about this job, and I say awesome, the old fashioned sense of the word, the big responsibility job, is you'll walk into a bedroom and someone you just met will tell you secrets they wouldn't tell their spouse. And you are privileged, and to people are honest with you in a way they're usually never honest with themselves. But if someone thinks they're having a heart attack, all the edifice that we construct around ourselves goes away, and people are brutally honest about you name it. And so if you're paying attention, filing away in the back of your mind, you have work to do up front. But if I'm an inveterate note taker, so after calls, I'll be scribbling stuff down. It has nothing to do with the call, but about the character. And so I'd be hard pressed to find a job where I get to meet so many people from all walks of life and have honest conversations with them about things, you know. So it's an incredible profession for a writer, I think.
Well, my hat's off to you. And by the way, thank you for your service, which I want to make sure I say, anybody who served in the military is just heads and shoulders in my mind above everybody. So thank you.
I appreciate that. I'll be honest with you, I owe more to the Marine Corps than I gave to them, for sure. You know, just, I was young and lost and sort of lacking some direction in life. I think you could tell by looking at me, I'm not like, people don't see me walking down the street and automatically go, that's a Marine. Cause I don't, you know, but I tell you, the little disciplines in life that you learn, and just, how to initiative and how to take, you know, ownership of things. I learned a lot of that little stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's not minimize by using the phrase little stuff, because I did a little research because I'm a fanatic for this kind of stuff. So I get into Wikipedia land, if you've ever visited there. And, I come to find out that there is, the United States Marine Corps is a unique branch of the military, I'm reading this here, that's extremely elite and fierce. But within the Marines, this is where I'm going, lies a special MOS that's even more elite and fearsome. It's the MOS 321, which tells me two things. One, you're in a true brand of specialized brothers. And number two, now I know where your Instagram name comes from.
Right. Yeah.
But what does MOS stand for? Just give me some.
Military Occupational Specialty.
Okay.
And actually, when I was in the Marine Corps, recon was what was called a B billet. Couldn't be your main job. You couldn't sign a contract to go to recon. You had to go to an infantry field and then try out for recon. So officially, I'm an 0341, which is a mortarman. I fired a mortar twice in my life in infantry school. And then I went right from infantry school to our version of the Navy SEALs have BUDS. Their version of BUDS when I was in recon was called Amphibious Reconnaissance School. It's now called Basic Reconnaissance Course, and it's out on the West Coast. When I went, it was up in Norfolk, up near Little Creek.
So, oh, yeah.
I tell people all the time, like, I was not, there were plenty of guys that tried out for the unit that were stronger, bigger, tougher, braver. But the reality is, it applies wholeheartedly to writing, because I know plenty of people that are better writers than me that I could name 20 of them right now that have not published yet. And it's all just about not quitting, being willing, like, they could try to drown me, run me to death, PT me, scream at me, but whatever they want to do, I wasn't ever going to quit. They could kick me out, but I was going to drown before I quit. And that was the only difference. There's a lot of tough guys that couldn't get through it because they quit, you know. And so I'm nothing special physically, but I'm stubborn, and I stick with things.
Well, folks, you're going to get to know Ted throughout the remainder of this podcast. And here's one thing, still reading some of my notes here. These Marines are trained in elite fighting tactics, tactical weapons. They're the go-to for many top secret missions in various countries around the world. Here's what it requires: hard work, discipline, and I want to put this in a T-shirt, an unmatched willpower to succeed. And that, my friend, is exactly, as you just said, is exactly what you need to be a writer. You have to have an unmatched willpower to succeed and say, you know, you can, Mr. Agent, you can say no. You can say no. Sally, agent, you can say no, but I'm going to keep going until somebody says, yeah.
So true. I have a really sophisticated way to deal with rejection. And we all get rejected, right? And it was eye-opening to me to meet, you know, best-selling published writers that will say they still get rejected even though they have bestsellers. But my really complicated method is I get the rejection. I go, okay, delete, move on. I don't stick it to the wall. I don't keep it with me. It's gone. When it's rejected, I just move on. Yeah. You don't need everybody to say yes. You just need one person.
All right. I got so many questions, but I want to get through. I like to do things in a certain kind of order. And I have to know this because I'm one of those guys that I gotta know stuff. What is the most bizarre thing you've ever run across on a call? And if you feel uncomfortable answering that, then tell me, but you don't impress me as being a guy about uncomfortable about much at all.
I'll tell you exactly what it is. And people don't really understand this. One of the characters in my book is a character named LD. He's based on a real guy who was called LB, who was, when sober, the most gentlemanly guy you'd ever want to meet, but had a really tough time with alcohol. So one morning I'm working for the EMS for the city of Worcester, Worcester EMS, working with my good friend, Paul Gomes. It's Christmas Eve, technically. It's like 3 o'clock Christmas morning. It's one of these weird Massachusetts Christmases where it's warm and it's humid. So it's this, the street, we're parked at this T intersection and it's shrouded in fog. We're underneath like a sodium light, you know, ready to take a left. It's like 3 a.m. We're exhausted. And out of the fog on one end emerges this guy, and it's LB. He's wearing like khaki pants, no shirt, no shoes. He's carrying a frozen turkey under his arm. He walks in front of the ambulance. He turns to us. He waves. And then he disappears into the fog on the other side of the street. And I remember sitting there for a minute after, and I looked at Paul, like, did we just see LB with a turkey? He was like, I think we did. You know, till this day, I can't explain it. I don't know, you know, why that part of the city, that time of the morning, no shirt, but a turkey.
And I love it. I love it. Not everybody can tell that story. Now, one more thing, because I just got to dive into the dark side. Have you ever been to an accident that had you saying by the end of it, nah, I think I need to pack it in now after what I just saw?
It's funny you say that. I firmly believe every paramedic and EMT has that one call that's out there, that if they were on, that would be it for them. I've come close. I had a 9-year-old boy that lost his legs in a car accident. I was working in flight medic at the time, and on the way to the hospital, he just kept asking me if he was going to make it to hockey practice that night. That was pretty awful. The call that I know would have ended my career, I was not on, thank goodness. It was up on this interstate in Massachusetts. This aunt had taken her niece and nephew out to an amusement park, and on the way back, she had some kind of psychotic break. Stripped them, everybody naked, ran out of the highway, and all three were killed by passing traffic. And I know medics that were on that call. And I think that for me, I think that would have been it. You know, so I definitely think every time you get up there, like, everybody has that one call that could do it to them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one more question, then we'll move off of that. I'm perverted somewhere. What had more stress for you, do you think, working? Stress and fear, maybe, working as an EMT or as a recon Marine. Is that an odd
question? Oh, I think I'm older, so being a paramedic is stressful because I see a little bit of life. When you're young, when you're 19 years old and traveling the world with a bunch of other 19-year-olds, and you're in the peak physical fitness of your life, and you're jumping on planes, and you're shooting, you feel invincible. So it was, none of it was stress, because I was just really didn't know any better. Like, you know, as I get older and you realize how tenuous sort of our existence on this planet can be, and how, you know, most, I say this a lot, you know, a lot of my patients that maybe, you know, when you go to cardiac arrest or you go to a bad traumatic call, like, nobody walked out of their house that morning expecting to die. And so every day is a blessing. You know, you got to put it to use, because no one is guaranteed this afternoon, forget tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, I don't ever get stressed. I think at this point, it's not that I've seen it all, but I've been doing this long enough that I know I have skills to sort of figure out how to, at least when I don't know what I'm doing, at least to manage it, to get the person to the people who do. I've got enough of that down. So there's, I don't want to deliver any more babies. I've delivered six, no more babies. That's really it. And at this point, I just don't want to be pooped on anymore if I can avoid it. That's a big plus for me. Yeah. And I want to get off shift on time. I've really narrowed my career goals down to those two things. Anything else is bonus. But as long as I don't get pooped on and I get out on time, it's a win. That shift was a win.
There's a scene in the book where this guy is has been drinking a little bit too much. And as they're carrying him down the steps, and he just hurls all over the two techs. And I just thought, there's little worse than that. That I can.
So of all the calls in the book, I wasn't on any of them. I borrowed, most of them are based on real calls I heard from other people. There's one call in the book I was on. That was the call. It was, and it sort of happened as depicted in the book. My partner and I, and he's my partner to this day, we went to we thought we were going to the Opera House in downtown Worcester, because we were working for a private ambulance company at the time. We were brand new EMTs. We didn't know the city all that well. And we pull up to what turned out to be a porno theater. They wouldn't turn the movie off. They wouldn't turn the lights on. We found a naked guy unconscious in a pile of vomit. We carried him down the stairs. He woke up. It turns out he was a prisoner who gotten out and just got drunk and went to the theater. And as we're going on this narrow stairway, I'm back and my partner, Scott, is at the guy's feet, and he just projectile vomits over and over and over. And it's as awful as you think.
Yeah. I do remember that now in the theater. I just gotten out of prison. Okay, we won't belabor that for those who are, might be having a meal about now, but thank you for that. All right, now I have to say this. Do you remember I sent you a note? What's today, Tuesday? I sent you a note, I think over the weekend, and I think I only said one line, something like, dude, you can write. Did I say something like that?
You made my weekend, absolutely. No, you, I show it to my wife, and I'll be like, oh, this is awesome. So no, thank you.
Well, I know that I have a tendency toward hyperbole, probably. I think because I've been a radio guy for my whole life, and you have to make some things bigger than they are for entertainment value. I read a lot of books. I know really quickly if a book's going to hold me. This friggin' thing, Every Hidden Thing, this book, I don't know what it is. It just grabbed me and would not let go. This is one of the best books I have read in a long time. And I kept saying to myself, why? Why is it so good? You have such a command of the English language. You have such an incredible way to set a scene. It's not just, hey, the sun's setting, it's a rosy colored glow over the city and the steam from the road rose. No, you paint a picture that I found myself, and I often take notes, and I'll put little sticky notes in there, and I'll go, oh my God, look at this sentence. Babe, come here a second. I'll say to my wife, Tammy, listen to this sentence. And she'll just stop and she'll like, wow. That's how geeked out I get about craftsmanship. So go ahead and let that sink in. I got more to say.
I'm basking in it. Thank you.
But there is no way on the planet that this is your first book. There's no way.
It's the first book I've finished and attempted to have published. I mean, I've been writing my whole life. I think, I grew up in a house with full of English majors. My mother was a newspaper nut. My father loved, he constantly was surrounded by books my whole life. And I've been writing my whole life. It's just, it wasn't until I was in my early 40s that I really decided, I wanted to try and publish. I always wrote for myself, never submitted anywhere, probably thankfully. It was just kind of learning the craft. And it sort of accelerated. I ended up going in 2013, I joined an MFA program, the Mountain View MFA. I know the big debate, MFA, no MFA, everybody's right. MFAs are wonderful. You absolutely don't need it. For me, it made sense. I didn't go into a lot of debt, number one, to do it. And number two, I wanted to accelerate my learning. I knew if I kept working, eventually I could I could learn everything I learned in the MFA program, but what I couldn't get was I met people whose sole job was writer. I met, I worked with Leslie Jamison and Wiley Cash and met these incredible people, and they were so generous with their time and their specialty, their expertise. I met guys like, John Vercher, who's, he remains one of my best friends. But I, for the first time, I was around a group of people that didn't ask me, where are you from? What do you do for a living? They would ask you, what are you writing? What are you working on? And so I fully understand, you don't need MFA. Some of my favorite writers, Jonathan Evison, guys like that, don't have MFAs. You don't need it. But for me, I wanted it. And it really accelerated my learning curve. I've always loved craft books as well. And listening to people, writers I respect, talk about how they got there. So I'm always sort of thinking about it. So it is my first novel, but yeah, I think that'd be unfair to say it's not my first writing. It's just the first time I've tried to get something published.
Okay. Two things I want you to walk away here remembering. It's going to be a highlight for you. I hope in some form or fashion. One is this, and I told this to my wife, and she knows because she sees me. I'm up at anywhere between 4:30 and 5, and I will read for an hour or two before I start my writing, before I start the podcast preparation, before I start my day. And it's got to be something good. If I'm going to be reading at 4:30, 5 o'clock, come on, right? But here's the one thing I want you to walk away hearing from David, not the host of a podcast. And I mean this. You make me want to be a better writer.
Oh, geez. Well, thank you.
When I read this, I said, I want to be able to write like that guy. I mean, I can't put it any more powerfully than that because...
Yeah, dude, I can't. Thank you. I mean, I'm a little overwhelmed. Thank you. Thank you. I definitely have people I feel that way about as well. So I thank you so much. I'm not so great with comments because, I have that, like every writer that's sort of like, you don't know if it's good or not. So you made my day. Thank you very much.
There are guys out there that I want to emulate, like Don Winslow's kind of like my hero. I love everything he writes. I can't get enough of it. We've been able to, wonderfully enough, strike up a friendship.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And every once in a while, though, I run across something. I'm like, man, I want to be able to craft a sentence like that guy because I'm not being bullshitting here. Then I'll go back and I'll look at some of my stuff and I'm like, I got to rework that. It's got to be more interesting than that. So anyway, there you go. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is I've completely forgotten, but it'll come back to me. I know what it is. I can't believe that this is your first book, but now that I understand that you got the MFA, you can tell that you have had a substantial bit of education because of the way that you structure scenes and sentences. It's not just pretty words and, pretty florally words. It's the way you craft them. So anyway, I cannot wait for number two. And if number two sucks, I'm going to be really disappointed.
Well, the pressure's on now, man. Holy cow. I'll be disappointed too, believe me.
And I got to ask, and I know this came out last year. I usually put a date in here when it came. I want to say if it's in October.
October.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. October 12th.
When's the next one?
Well, so I'm in the middle of a book that's more of historical fiction than crime fiction. So there was, when you go to Paris Island, one of the things you hear about Marine Corps boot camp is this incident from the 1950s where six recruits were marched into a swamp and died, the Ribbon Creek incident. And I live in this little town in central Massachusetts. And every time I drive by my house, I leave my house, I go by this big brick colonial. And the way that connects is the drill instructor that drowned these recruits by accident. They had a huge trial. Chesty Poehler, the patron saint of the Marine Corps, actually came and testified on the drill instructor's behalf. He beat the charges, stayed in the Marine Corps for three more years. He got out on a medical disability, but I think if you know anything about the rest of his life, I think he was just heartbroken. He never intended to kill anybody. He was not a brutal guy. And he got the Marine Corps and retired to the brick colonial right by my house. So every time I drive by the house, I think of this guy. And then I've been able to meet people in town that knew who he was. And he's a really interesting guy. And at the same time during the pandemic, I don't know if you've read any David Peace. David Peace, James Ellroy, are probably my favorite living writers in the English language. And David Peace, a British guy, and he wrote this incredible series about these crimes that took place in occupation era Tokyo. And he had one of his influences was the story by Kurosawa called Rashomon, and then I forget the name of the In the Garden, I forget the name of the second story, but it's basically tells the story of the death of a samurai through 17 different viewpoints, including the dead samurai. And so I read that the Kurosawa collection during the pandemic, and I'm reading lots of peace and I'm thinking about this story. So I'm writing, I'm about 30,000 words in, so we'll see. But the story about the Ribbon Creek incident told from the viewpoints of, varying viewpoints, including dead recruits and some other folks. And I'm really enjoying it. So I don't know if it'll get published, but I know I'm having fun writing it. So I get that going.
All right, folks, now listen to that statement. I don't know if it's going to get published, but I'm having fun writing it. And that is a true blue writer. That's a guy who goes, yeah, this is what I want to do. That's I love that. By the way, since you dropped that name, on the top of the back of the book, this is a righteous, hard-charging, bell-ringing mother blanker debut novel by, James Ellroy.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
If we had never sold this novel, that blurb would have made every minute I spent on this book more than worth it. More than worth it. My agent worked at Sobel Weber back when, and so she knew James Ellroy through there. And so she just sent him the book, and he gave this incredible blurb. And the best part is the blurb is really long. And at one point he says, I'm the bastard child he had with a Bengal tigress, which I'm going to tattoo that on my chest, I think. It's awesome. It's awesome. It's one of my favorite parts of the whole process was having James Ellroy say those things about my book.
He's no lightweight hitter either. I mean, and then the very next, I love this, the very next quote, and then I'm going to get off this, combines the best of James Ellroy's noir cityscapes with the narrative impulses of Dennis Lehane. Flanagan is a powerful and undeniably gifted writer, and his debut novel proves that. This is by Wiley Cash, New York Times bestselling author.
That means a lot to me.
Yeah, I mean, come on. You got four heavy hitters, four great quotes, first time out. Wow. I don't want to belabor. I don't want to use this sentence too many times, but geez, I want to be you.
Yeah. You have better hair though, Dave. You don't want my hair.
I think one of my questions was going to be, and because this is a standalone, this is clearly not a series. So it's a two-part question. Number one, will all your books, as far as you know, be standalones? And number two, which is the perfect lead into that, is do you have a series in your head? I know agents love series because you kind of build this world and you keep filling it.
You know, never say never. But I don't envision writing a series. As a reader, I tend to gravitate towards standalones. I don't have a good reason for that. I think, as a writer though, I always want to try different things. I don't want to, do that, which of course, as a huge admirer of the Charles Wolford, Hope Mosley novels and other, a guy who loves all kinds of series novels, as a reader, I do like them, but as a writer, I think I have too many different forms I want to try and things I want to experiment with. I don't have a series plan, but what I think I might do would be sort of like, what Ellroy does. I mean, I know he does quartets in which some major characters from one book will play a minor role in the next book. I could see these characters making appearances, but I don't see a Thomas Archer, a book four in the Thomas Archer series. I think he's kind of said everything he can say in that one book, and now he's sort of living his life. I'm fascinated, actually, I've had this question before, and the one character, I think if I were to write another book about a character in this book, it was Lou McCarthy, the reporter. I could see writing about her again. But, I don't know. I mean, I think I definitely want to write about Worcester again. I'd kind of like to do for Worcester what, William Kennedy did for Albany, like write about these cities that aren't, it's not Boston, it's not New York City, but it's a city that has a million stories. I mean, Worcester is an incredible, talk about a fertile ground for a crime, for crime fiction or for noir, you know, or any, really any kind of fictional mode. You know, Worcester is a great, it's a city with an interesting history all its own, but a huge chip on its shoulder because it comes in second place to Boston all the time. Yeah. Feel it acutely. And so, but it's where all my relatives on my father's side came over from Ireland in the late 19th century. And then we lived in a triple decker in Worcester. And then the family sort of spread out, like a lot of Irish families did, to the suburbs. And so I feel both that history acutely, but also like I'm not part of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really jealous of my buddies. I have guys I play hockey with that are like one of seven brothers that grew up in Maine South to a huge Irish clan in Worcester. I am so jealous of those guys. They have that history. So I see writing about Worcester again, for sure. I just don't know what characters will pop up.
Couple things. I love this Thomas Archer character. You really thought that he was just a loser bad guy. And in the end, it kind of feels a little bit differently. And Lou McCarthy, she was wonderful. And you thought you had her pegged as a character until this move that she makes at the end. And you go, wow, there's goodness there. Anyway, folks, you got to read this book. I do want to ask, and actually I want to go back to something. I like the way you said that, because I'm with you, Ted. I have this, I have a couple of characters in my head that have been with me for a while, and I did a couple of short series together. None of these are published by, you know, the big boys like you. They're all self-published. But what I like, the upside is you create the world and then you just put them in a new world. So that's kind of cool. The downside is I'm with you. There's so much I want to experience. And so I have so many different stories in my head at any given time that I'm like, why would I just keep doing a series when there's so many different? So I'm on the fence about that. And maybe you'll just run into an opportunity where your agent says, Ted, I think you've got a great idea here for a series, and then it'll be decided for you.
I'm open to any, you know, that's the thing. I'm open to anything. Like, I'm really not closed off to any idea.
I've said it. I'm going to say it again. It's just hard to believe that this is your first book. I cannot wait. Please let me be one of the first people that read your next book. Would you do that for me?
You got it.
Yeah.
That's a deal. Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you've heard this show before, you've probably heard this little thing I do, rapid fire questions.
Yep.
Absolutely. Then you know you're ready for it, don't you?
Well, we'll see. I'm going to give it a shot.
Rapid fire question number one for Ted Flanagan. You've just been called out to a horrific accident, Ted. I'm sorry to say, it's terrible. However, as you arrive, you only have one tool to help save lives. Only one tool. You reach in your bag. Oh my gosh, there's only one tool. It's weird. I don't know how it happened, but what is that one tool and why'd you pick that one?
Tourniquet. Tourniquet. Because stop bleeding is the, you know, you want to keep people's hearts pumping, keep the blood inside the body, not outside the body. And if I need to breathe for them, God forbid, I have tools for that, but I don't do mouth to mouth, but if needed, I could have, nobody should do mouth to mouth. But a tourniquet, yeah, stop bleeding, control the bleeding. That's for a big traumatic incident. That's the one I would choose.
All right, folks, your EMT is spoken. Question number two, you've just pulled 4 weeks of straight 14 plus hour days, probably something you know pretty well. That's the bad news. The good news is you and your wife just won an all expense paid trip to an exotic island. It can be anywhere in the world. Where is it and why?
Mallorca in the Mediterranean.
Nice.
I love the Mediterranean. I love everything about the Mediterranean. When I was in the Marines, I spent a year floating around the Mediterranean on an aircraft carrier of all things, and loved Greece and, you know, Italy. And but I go to Mallorca. Beautiful. And I think that's where there's one of my favorite writers, a guy, Tim Baker, wrote The City Without Stars. Incredible book. I think he lives there, or he lives out there anywhere, near there anyway. But eat piece of cake.
Dude, I need a producer for this to be able to write down all the books that you've mentioned. I got some reading to do. All right, now, number three, question number three leads off of number two. All right, so the good news is you've picked that island and you're there. Here's the bad news. A hurricane just blew through, leaving you with no electricity. What's the one tool you're glad you thought ahead and packed in your carry-on, and why?
Solar panels.
Huh?
Solar panels, little travel solar panels. Like, I could charge everything in my little USB-powered fan that I thought to bring. And the, oh, yeah, piece of cake.
Oh, my God. Were you a Boy Scout, too?
Listen, I know about packing lightweight creature comforts. You know, you learn a lot when you travel light, freeze at night, but you learn how to do little things like I used to bring a little white gas stove and little cans of ravioli, and everybody else be eating MREs. I'd be making little, oh yeah, I had it down to a science.
So that was the bad news. Question number four, here's the good news. The electricity has come back on. Fresh water and food has arrived, along with two people to serve you. They both happen to be people you've always wanted to meet in person, and they've just shown up here on the island. Who are they and why?
Oh, boy. Sebastian Vettel is a Formula One driver. I'm a huge Formula One fan, and he seems like a really funny, fun guy to have around, for sure. And then the writer Jonathan Evason, because he makes his whole persona is like he loves to hang out, talk, and drink beer. So I think those two would be right at the top of my list.
That's awesome, Ted. That's so good. And really, at the end of the day, is there anything a good cold beer doesn't solve?
Very few problems. Very few problems. Homer Simpson said, beer, the cause of and solution to all life's problems. You know? Yeah. Don't overindulge. Everything in moderation, but absolutely.
All right, before we wrap, I do want to ask you, if you had a chance to sit down, this isn't a rapid fire, but if you had a chance to sit down and speak to a room full of kids growing up, or college kids trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, or just a room full of people who really love your books and they are predominantly writers themselves, what kind of advice would you give a writer who maybe hasn't had the success you've had so far? Maybe they're thinking about doing this as a career. They're even thinking about maybe quitting their day job or at least pushing it off to the side. But you got one good succinct piece of advice you'd share?
I honestly would convince them to have a job that gets them out in the world, that introduces them to people, because the main coin of the realm for a writer are the characters you create. Is the character, the characters you create are the coin of the realm, right? And so I'm actually always amazed by people that go right from high school to the academy to working in the academy, and then they write novels. And then those novels tend to be about lonely professors, right? So I don't know how you write if you're not in the world in some capacity or talking to people, getting to know people. So like podcasts, I think you meet all sorts of people. You're talking, you're firing your brain all the time. EMS, like I said earlier, I think that's my muse. That's where I meet people. They end up in my books and my stories, but they're not not because of whatever has happened to them, but for who they are. So like I definitely recommend people have a job. Leslie Jamison pointed this out once. She's this incredible essayist and writer, but she used to say that she loved when people wrote about people with jobs, people with professions, because like in the real world, we all go do something. Like, I wish I was I would love to just write, sit in my little office in my house all day and write. But I do appreciate the fact that I get out and I have a job that also fires up another part of my brain. And, you know, I have some expertise in other stuff other than just writing. I think it all informs the writing. And so I would suggest them, don't be so fast to jettison the idea of a day job right off the bat. Like, go do something for a few years. You know, writing, you can write your whole life, but I think your writing's going to be better if you're living as well, I think.
Your writing's going to be better if you're living as well. That's a great line. Well, folks, if you'd like to learn more about my new friend Ted Flanagan, go to tedflanagan1nintheMiddle.com, as you'll see on the screen. Follow Ted on Twitter, as I do, at TedEMTP. And Instagram, stalk him there. I do. Everyone should. At Ted_Flanagan_0321, which we've learned what that means.
It's pretty clear when I got my social accounts. I didn't think out my handle very well. I just... Should this be a little easier to remember.
Well, and here's that is a that's a really great point, because sometimes when we're starting out, we're just like wanting to be clever. But as you start building the fan base and audience and friendships and so forth, you go, oh, why didn't I come up with something better? But you know what? You can always change it. Ted, this was totally awesome. And man, you're a mad talent.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Dave. This has been as great as I knew it would be. I saw, you know, when I saw your, when I first started following your podcast, I'm like, I got to be on that. I got to talk to this guy. So thank you, man. The pleasure's all mine. 100%.
Well, mission accomplished. And, you know, you're one of those guys that I, you know, I talk to a lot of, I'm very, very blessed. I get to talk to a lot of really heavy hitters. And you, and I was just before I got on with you, I was working on my list for March. I got a killer March coming. And which, let me double check something. Yes, you're among the greats in March. So.
Oh, fantastic. I'll be listening anyway. So
yeah,
but thank you for including me there.
But I just want to say that you know, there are certain guys that I, especially that are kind of new in the business, that I want to follow, and anything I can do to help. And you're one of those. So
wonderful. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it so much. We'll stay in touch.
Absolutely. Once again, thanks to Ted. Don't you wish him great luck? And this book, Every Hidden Thing, trust me, you read it, you're gonna love it. Now, next week, I have been admiring this guy from afar for a very, very long time. People Magazine calls him the master of the ticking bomb suspense. My good friend Meg Gardner says he writes probably one of the most detailed outlines as he's preparing for a new book of anyone she's ever met. Jeffrey Deaver is his name. Yeah, you've heard of him. And The Final Twist is the book that I'm reading. We may cover this book. We may cover another one. Who knows? But Jeffrey Deaver, New York Times bestselling author on this show. Oh, man, I am geeked. All right. I'm David Temple, and I'll see you next time right here on The Thriller Zone.
The Thriller Zone has been presented by Blackstone Publishing and the exciting new techno thriller 4 Minutes, now available from your favorite bookseller. Learn more at blackstonepublishing.com.